Hello and welcome to a one-off edition of the House of Comments. My name's Emma Burnell and I'm a political journalist, and I'm joined today by Chris Clark, who is a former Labour press officer and is the author of a new book, or newish book. Chris and I have been trying to get together to do this for some time, called Warring Fictions, Left Populism and Its Defining Myths. So, Chris, tell me what the book's all about.
Hi, Emma. Well, yeah, the book is about it's about what's happened within the Labour Party for the past 5 years since the rise of since Corbyn's election as Labour leader. And it's seeking to try and get to the crux of where I believe the difference between these two sides of Labour exist. I'm coming at it from a kind of sort of unapologetically somebody who was quite sceptical about Corbyn pretty much from day one. But it's trying to make an argument about where the real difference between the two sides of Labour lies, and really what the kind of what people's issue is with Corbyn, because it feels like the whole debate is based on a bit of a kind of a whole set of non sequiturs, and no one's really can even agree about where we disagree, if that makes sense.
Sure. And in the book, you define the difference between, I mean, we'll say two sides. Obviously, there is a spectrum where people sit, but the two sides is Labour populism, which is where you see the Corbynism coming from, and Labour pluralism. Do you want to outline a little bit more about what you mean by those terms? I think it'd be useful when we're talking about this argument to understand the defining terms at the start.
Yes, yeah, completely. Where they come from is my frustration all the way through with Corbyn from day one was not that I regarded him as being too left-wing or too much of a socialist, or kind of supporting a level of equality or social justice that I thought was, you know, a step too far. My issue was with the kind of us against them narratives, the conspiracy theories which seem to be seeping into the Labour Party, the very cherry-picked version of the past, so the idea of this kind of all-encompassing decline into neoliberalism and things. And I really, that whole way of seeing the world, the whole world view, I really couldn't get on board with and struggled with. And my main issue with it was a sort of, as I saw it, a populist worldview. It was always based on fighting an enemy. It was based on kind of paranoia about elites and the powerful. I saw it really as a left populist ideology. And what I've been trying to promote with the book as an alternative is a form of left pluralism, which I see left pluralism as being a politics which is still in favour of redistribution of wealth, social justice, community, equality, fairness, values like this, but which does not look to say that the political spectrum is a moral spectrum, and which doesn't see every problem in the world as being authored by powerful elites pulling the strings, and which doesn't rely on these sort of decline narratives as the kind of basis of everything having gone wrong. So that's the core difference, is about two mindsets or worldviews or outlooks, populism and pluralism. And I'm trying to champion a more pluralist and tolerant approach on the political left.
So in terms of your definition of the populist left, what you've outlined the sort of three basic essential narratives that you feel define them, I guess, define them negatively. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah. The three narratives, and I call them in the book the Dark Knight, the Puppet Master, and the Golden Era. And there, I see them as the kind of almost the vices, the vices of the left. There are sort of our Achilles' heels and the traps we always fall into. So the Dark Knight describes this idea that the political spectrum is a moral spectrum, The puppet master describes this idea that we live in a thinly disguised dictatorship rather than a broadly functioning democracy. And the golden era refers to this kind of idea of an original socialism, which everything's deteriorated from. And I see them as very much as negative things, which firstly mean that we end up in ethical dead ends, you know, around the anti-Semitism stuff being one of the most obvious examples, but also that we end up electorally failing because we, you know, if you start to see the political spectrum as a battle of good against evil, you end up alienating a whole lot of people and getting results like the one we got in December of last year.
And I'd like to go through them in a bit more depth, sort of one by one. The golden era thing really fascinates me because I think you're right. There is, I mean, I don't think, let's be honest, that political nostalgia is confined to either the left or the hard left. So I think that, you know, I mean, I've written quite a lot about the fact that I believe that the Labour Party on all of its different sides harks back to some sort of golden era thinking, whether you believe that's pre-Thatcherism or whether you believe that's Blair, we all have a danger of falling into those traps.
Yeah, I definitely think that's the case. And one thing I should say with the book, when I'm talking about these three myths, I don't believe that they are confined to the Corbynite left. I think large parts of the mainstream left and the centre left, which have bought into them. I think they're most extreme on the Corbynite left, but I think, for instance, that the kind of the idea that the Tories are the kind of immoral in some way goes far beyond that sort of politics.
But
in terms of the golden era, yeah, I think large swathes of the political spectrum are highly nostalgic, and indeed large swathes of society are highly nostalgic. And if you look at the sort of UKIP, Nigel Farage sort of politics, that is absolutely full of nostalgia and full of this idea of a decline into kind of us being this woolly liberal metropolitan elite sort of country or whatever it is that they like to talk about. But I feel that on the populist left, that narrative is particularly strong and is really quite pronounced. When you look at this, the idea that the period, the kind of 1940s and 50s and the period immediately after the war, was this really hazy period where we were this tolerant, community-focused socialist country, and that's all gone out with the... There's been this all-encompassing slide into selfishness and individualism and bigotry. That kind of idea underlines a lot of what the Corbynite left, how they see things, whether it's Zara Sultana's maiden speech about 40 years of Thatcherism, or whether it's Ken Loach's a film like Spirit of 45 by Ken Loach. There's this idea of an all-encompassing decline, and I'm not saying that things haven't got worse on some fronts for the left. You know, inequality has got more extreme, but the problem is if you take this very misty-eyed, cherry-picked version of the past, and you forget that the 1940s and 50s and 60s was also an era of, you know, before the civil rights process, before a whole set of other things had happened. So what I'm really driving at with the golden era is this very cherry-picked idea of the past, which kind of brushes to one side all the bits that aren't consistent with our values from the past.
Yeah, absolutely. And I do feel, I think that's a danger from lots of different parts of both the left and the right. But yeah, I think there is definitely a kind of Panglossian view sometimes of a past that didn't really exist. And actually, if you lived through the post-war period, you know, it wasn't actually that happy a time. We did create some wonderful institutions and welfare safety net, the NHS, the Open University, which is the one everyone forgets about, but is fantastic. Yeah. But we created those things because there was an awful lot of hardship and need. And it was a response to, you know, the war. Now, we're in a time now of crisis that's probably the greatest crisis we've had since the Second World War. And it may well be that we come out of it and have to do similar things again. And I'm sure, you know, people across the left will be arguing that, that that's exactly what we should be doing, and the state will need to step in. But let's not be under any illusion that good responses to bad things don't come with bad things.
Yeah, that's it. I couldn't agree more with what you've just said there. It's that the entire reason we had to create the NHS late 1940s was because we didn't have one by definition. So and in a way, what the nostalgia comes from and what the golden era comes from is a nostalgia for the struggle and for the spirit that made that struggle bearable. So I think it's always a little bit of a it always is remembering times when actually things were pretty difficult, but when the progress, it's almost a recollection of when the progress was being made in a way, and it raises difficult, and like you say, a lot of those things were only possible because we had had taxes of sort of 80 and 90 and 100% during the Second World War so they came as a direct product of very extreme hardship, and that ability to weigh up the fact that that past was deeply imperfect, I would say at least as imperfect as our current society, is kind of missing in the golden era. It charts this kind of really glorious period which just deteriorated into this kind of chrome dystopia that we now live in, and I think it can be quite dangerous. And it's a very uninspiring narrative for the electorate. I think it's a bit of a cliche to say that Labour prime ministers always have a vision for the future, but if you look at the kind of white heat of technology or Clement Attlee's campaigns based on facing the future, and if you ultimately are backward looking, I think it's very, very electorally damaging as well as being kind of factually wrong.
There's a quote in Deborah Mattinson's book, Talking to a Brick Wall, which is all about sort of political communications, and she says voters never say thank you, they say what's next. And I think that's absolutely reasonable. So that should always be the frame through which any offer is made. It is really important that we are able to critique the Thatcherite economic approach, that we continue to have an argument about how to implement socialist ideals as best as possible, call it socialism, call it social democracy, call it what you want. But that doesn't mean that we should lie about what came before.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And I think I'm not really in the book trying to argue that there wasn't this massive sea change moment. Where, you know, in 1979, I do think an awful lot of things changed. But the problem with, and a lot of things economically did move to the right. I think it's very important to argue against that. To argue against that happening and to say that there is an alternative. But part of the reason that shift happened was that the entire global context changed. I think we were becoming an increasingly interconnected world, increasingly globalized, and large companies were increasingly indifferent to national borders. And it was so that was there was a fundamentally changing context. Now, obviously, we had a prime minister who was very much ideologically aligned with shrinking the state and things anyway, but a lot of these big changes that have happened have been a change in the whole global context in which we're operating as a country. And I think it's really the solutions will now be fundamentally, if we want to drastically reduce inequality, for instance, the solutions will be very different to what they were in the 1940s and 1950s. The solutions might involve, pan-European wealth taxes, or even ideas like some kind of international or kind of Europe-wide minimum wage. These sorts of ideas, I mean, they're kind of very back of a fag packet things, but the international approach will have to be the lever by which we change these things. And I think the pretense that we can just roll back the clock and go back to the kind of idea of 90% income tax is going to be it's going to lead us really down a dead end.
Yeah, no, and I've never been a big fan of socialism in one country approaches, because if you believe that, if you're like me, you are a socialist, then you want that for everybody, not just for the people who happen to live in your geographical area.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's that's completely true. And the kind of problem with the siege economy is that, if it's fairness for a kind of pocket that is isolated from the rest, then that isn't really fairness. And also the problem with socialism in one country is socialism in one country doesn't work as well if you're the only country in the world practicing it as it does if every other country is also practicing socialism in one country, if you see what I mean. It's an obvious point, but if everyone's a socialist in one country, that can kind of work. But if you're the only one doing it, then it doesn't work, because everyone just does deals over your head or whatever anyway. So and people leave or people go elsewhere and stuff. So in conclusion to what you're saying, I definitely think that there are big alternatives to Thatcherism, but those need to come through engaging with the globalization process, not retreating from it.
Yeah. So I think we've probably comprehensively dismissed the golden era.
Yeah.
The second one is the puppet master. Do you want to go into a little bit more detail about what you mean by that?
Yeah, the puppet master is the idea of a sort of all-powerful elite controlling our lives. And it's it taps into ideas about the mainstream media. It taps into ideas about this kind of 1% controlling our lives. It taps into conspiracy theories, kind of truther conspiracy theories about 9/11 at the more extreme end of the myth. But what it is really is this idea that that all of our problems are authored by a small, powerful group of people, and that they deliberately create these problems to distract from their own bad things they're doing or to line their own pockets. And it's quite fundamental to how a lot of people on the left see the world. But I think it ultimately what it leads to is this idea that we don't really live in a democracy. We live in a dictatorship, and we're controlled and brainwashed or kind of fed things by the media or coerced into doing things. So it's that part. It's really the thin end of the conspiracy theorist wedge, which says that there's more power that we're subject to than we realise.
And I mean, I sort of both agree with you and disagree with you, if you know what I mean. This is a really complicated one, because I absolutely agree that there is no grand conspiracy. There isn't someone pulling the strings, whether that be George Soros or Donald Trump. But I do feel that there are people willing to benefit from the inequalities of our society with little moral hazard to them in doing so. And I know that's not quite the same thing as them being in control and in charge, but I'm just trying to tease out how far you go in not talking about that so that you don't sound like a conspiracist loon.
Yeah, this is a very good question. And with this myth, what I've tried to stress in the book is that I'm not saying we're not subject to any power. I mean, even clearly the fact that laws exist, which at the moment mean that all the pubs have to close, show that there are powerful forces in the world. But what the puppet master is a criticism of is a constant over-reliance on those forces as an explanation for everything. So a kind of idea that there's this collusion between the media and the kind of, you know, the billionaire class and the eaten, educated politician, and they're all sort of kind of working together to keep the decent rest of us down. Now, I'm not claiming there aren't self-interested people at the top of society, just as there are self-interested people in the middle of society and even at the bottom of society. There are self-interested people everywhere. And, you know, I'm not criticizing the puppet master because I'm looking to defend the behavior of Philip Green or something, if you know what I mean. But what I'm criticizing is that as a default explanation, if you take, for instance, the fact that Labour is, Corbyn was kind of treated badly by the press and things, the whole idea of the MSM, mainstream media conspiracy, completely consumed Labour, I'd say, for really the last 5 years. And it meant that Labour failed to understand actually why it wasn't doing very well it wasn't getting very good coverage. Because the truth is that newspapers like The Sun or The Mail or whoever it may be, or all newspapers, I think, are they're commercial entities. They're interested in selling to it's a kind of supply and demand, selling to their readerships. And in the most part, they're simply telling, you know, reflecting back at the public what their little pockets of the public want to hear. But the puppet master leads to a completely different analysis of why that is, which is that these groups are kind of coordinating with other powerful groups and are crushing the rest of us deliberately and in a concerted way. And that is sometimes very openly and flagrantly. That idea is openly and flagrantly said in some parts of the left. In others, it's more of a kind of tacit belief. But it's always that is the explanation for why the media behave towards Labour in a certain ways. And that, in my view, fundamentally misses the point about the media, just to use the media as this example, because actually the truth is that the media is a kind of commercial free-for-all, you know, based on, you know, short-termism and cults of personality and a kind of race to the bottom to sell them the most newspapers. It isn't, in my view, a kind of powerful plot by a group to brainwash and submit and suppress the rest of society, but the puppet master allows you to think it is, and therefore to completely misunderstand how the media operate and fail to engage with them. So that's kind of a good example of it as a case of how far you go in buying into the puppet master, is that yes, there are powerful people, but we do ultimately live in a democracy, and those people tend to be reflecting public opinion, or ultimately, even if they try not to reflect public opinion, they're ultimately reliant on public opinion.
Yeah, I think that's reasonable. I think the question for me lies, what is a conspiracy? And what is a system? I think that is where you have to untangle things a little bit, because, you know, capitalism, particularly the way that it's set up at the moment with vast global corporations who do like a little bit of everything and aren't really based in any one place, don't really exist in any one place. That's not a conspiracy. That's an end result of the system that I would say is the wrong system for governing our finances. But others might see that as a conspiracy of those organisations in themselves. So it's about, I guess for me, it's about how we talk about it as much as how we view it.
Yeah, completely. I mean, again, just to stress when I'm criticising the puppet master myth, it isn't that I'm saying that the 1% don't exist, you know, that 1% of people don't own this huge amount of wealth, or that I think that's an acceptable thing. I think that levels of wealth inequality are completely unacceptable. But I think that that they are ultimately the product of an organic system, which is really very, very chaotic, anarchic free-for-all, and is in some ways become more of a free-for-all, actually, in the globalized world, where these businesses can relocate. Politicians can't do anything to tax them, so they end up beholden to them. So it's the idea of everything being authored and planned and rigged that is where for me the issue comes in, because I think even a very powerful person who's, I don't know, a kind of senior director at a bank isn't really thinking about, or a kind of FTSE 100 company isn't predominantly spending their life thinking, how can I add extra leverage, how can I suppress the democratic will of the people. I think they're just thinking, well, my job is to make more money for this company, and how can I do that effectively. And it's I think the world is a bit more banal than the puppet master myth imagines.
And I think, you know, we, as a species, we are really, really bad at just kind of trying to simplify things, and that's where a lot of this comes in, isn't it? It would be so much better if there were someone behind the curtain pulling all the strings.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's appealing as an idea, and there's lots and lots of circumstantial evidence that makes you think it's true, you know, whether it's the MP's expenses scandal or the kind of behaviour of Rupert Murdoch or whatever else it is. But I think it's, the truth is a little bit more mundane than that. I'm not saying that powerful people don't do bad things or behave corruptly, but the truth is just a bit more boring.
Yeah. Now, although I interviewed Angela Regal about her book, Hardly a Corbynista, we were talking about, you know, the definition of socialism and capitalism. The capitalism is in itself, it's not immoral, it's amoral. It sometimes has immoral ends, and the role of socialism is to impose moral ends on an amoral system, a system that hasn't got a morality, for good or for evil.
Yeah, completely. That's a very nice summation in some ways of what it is, what the puppet master argument is, really. And it's a big thing that the puppet master causes the left to misunderstand, I think, is that capitalism is, as you say, is amoral, not immoral. It's anarchic. Part of the problem is that no one's in control, and you need people to intervene and set the clock back to zero more often so that inequality doesn't develop. But the idea is instead that it's this authored construct which misses one of the biggest arguments that exists against capitalism.
Great. Okay, so moving on to your final factor, the Dark Knight. So this is the one that you and I have I think crossed swords over before, so it'd be interesting. So if you could lay out the argument for us to start with.
Yeah, it's I think it was you that said to me when I explained this to you, you said, do you mean Batman? And I was like, no. But it's
I was like, why are you naming it after Batman? I don't like Batman.
It's the Dark Knight is it's Knight with a K, so the idea of a kind of dark
so
Knight
versus Batman.
White Knight. Yeah, that is as well, you're right. sadly I think it's too late to start renaming my myth, so it's the idea of this kind of that politics is a clash between good and evil, and that the left is moral and good, and the right is spiteful and self-interested and kind of immoral. And this idea that politics is ultimately always must be a clash between the goodies on the left and the baddies on the right. And it has a whole set of consequences, in my view. It leads to moral tribalism and the sorts of partisanship that we've seen over the past few years, where we apply really silly double standards to stuff that's going on. It leads to the Labour Party to split, because the people who are a couple of notches closer to the centre are dismissed as being essentially Tories, because it's a moral spectrum, and it means that any small policy difference has the capacity to become a question which cuts to the quick of, or cuts to the core of who a person is. And it leads a whole set of policy issues as well to be viewed through this system of good against evil. So let's take nationalisation and privatisation, or intervention abroad and versus pacifism. The argument is that one of these is innately moral and the other one is innately not, and you always need to side with one. And that, you know, that creates quite troublesome issues, because nationalisation is not correct on every single point. So it's this idea that a struggle between good and evil is at the core of politics, and there's a, you know, it has, whether it's class war, whether it's cold war, whether it's culture war, there has to be a battle between us and them.
I mean, I kind of agree to an extent. Again, it's all about the nuances, isn't it? It's I think in terms of this moral or immoral thing, I think people give themselves too much license for poor behaviours because they believe they're doing them towards moral ends. And I think the left are really guilty of that, but I think the right are really guilty of that too. And I don't mean the right of the Labour Party particularly, I mean, you know, in general. Yeah. I think where I struggle is that I think politics has to find a balance between it being something that is about belief, ideology, call it morality if you want to, and technocracy and what matters is what works. And there's got to be a comfortable place somewhere in between those two. Because otherwise, I think if you just go too far, and I've kind of gone on a bit of a journey with this whole thing. I mean, I wrote a piece probably about 10 years ago now, maybe slightly less, about the Labour Party is a moral crusade or it is nothing. And I used to love that quote. And then I started hating it because I saw what it did to people and how blindly people behave because they felt they were on a moral crusade. But I don't want to leave it behind completely. I think there are good and bad things in the world, and we should be able to name the bad. I think there are bad people currently running the UK and the US. And I think I need to be able to say, I don't want Donald Trump to be president for moral reasons. But so I just struggle with having an absolutist approach, I suppose, to morality and politics.
Yeah, I can see that. And I can see it's in of the three myths, as you've articulated, in some ways, it's the one that pushes Labour, I think. It pushes Labour most into places it's really not that comfortable with. Because and there are limits to it. You know, am I saying that the far right are moral? Well, really, I can't hand on heart say that. But I think that there has to be. I would agree with you that Boris Johnson, for instance, is not a moral man at all. But I don't think that's because he's a. I don't think that's really because he's a Tory. I think that a lot of conservatives subscribe to their own version of what's moral for society, which is they believe that in personal responsibility, individual freedom from the state, growth being more important than equality, maintaining traditions being a way of binding society together, whatever it might be. And I do think most conservatives are not doing it from a position of pure spite and self-interest, and an acknowledgement of that actually makes us firstly better able to understand those people, and secondly better able to actually argue with them. Because, you know, arguing against Ian Duncan Smith on the basis that he claims to support social justice but his policies are the very antithesis of social justice, how does he square that circle? I think is quite an effective way of arguing against Ian Duncan Smith. Whereas arguing that he, you know, he wishes to wash his hand in the blood of the poor kind of a thing by cutting benefits, which is borderline the sort of arguments you were seeing from parts of Labour, certainly on social media for a long time, just is like water off a duck's back to someone like that, because they can go, well, I'm not. And I think most of the public thinks they're not as well. But to go back to your bigger point, I think the fear of a technocracy is a very difficult aspect of this, because that the friction and the idea that the other side are a kind of that clash is quite a central thing that motivates people into politics. Even people who are very centrist these days were often, you know, the sort of Liz Kendalls of this world were often motivated to go into politics because they were angry about what the Tories were doing. So I do accept that there's some difficulties with engagement around this, but how you engage people in politics and don't make it something that is a sort of the realm of the expert witness and the lab technician. But it just feels like we've gone such a long way the other way with some of this stuff. And I also think that, even though I'm not saying that politics is, I think it's generally quite unhelpful to make it into a moral spectrum, I don't think that means that you can say that you can't say that other people are wrong. I mean, I think the hard Brexiteers were absolutely wrong about the direction for the country. It was a disaster. It was going to get a, it's once the kind of coronavirus stuff is addressed, the question of whether we have a hard Brexit will remain an absolutely disastrous policy for the country. And it doesn't stop you from having very strong opinions, I think, but it stops you from dehumanizing the other side in a way that I think pollutes politics in a way.
Yeah, I think I think the dehumanisation is definitely an issue. And that happens just to people who are just a couple of degrees to your right or your left. I think it does happen on both sides within the Labour Party. I think that is something that I think is slightly missing from the populism versus pluralism argument, because if you look at the way that the transference of feelings about not just the politics, but the morality of Corbynism has been transferred from Corbyn to Rebecca Long Bailey by some people in the more centre of the party, I do feel that that is unfair and is behaving in the same way as you see when you've got that kind of same moral argument coming from the hard left. So I think we're all capable of dark knighting a little bit.
Yeah, I would agree with that, and I would say that I have points writing the book made me question my own extent to which I was dark knighting the far left. And I think that's a really important lesson for the centre left, is that the frustration with the situation cannot lead into, say, you know, the argument that anyone who voted for Labour under Corbyn is a racist or something like, because of anti-Semitism, is the sort of thing I've seen started to be chucked around
Yeah, I've heard people say to me that anyone who votes for Richard Bergen should be thrown out of the party, which is just a vile thing to say.
Yeah, and is certainly not.
I'm not going to vote for Richard Bergen in a million years, but I'm very happy to share a party, a pluralist party, with people I disagree with.
Yeah, completely. And my argument really in the book is that there should be Labour should be able to be a very broad church as long as it tolerates those different strains, and that's the basic argument, I suppose, about the Dark Knight, at least in relation to Labour Party. I suppose the only place where I would differ from you is I do feel that the part of politics and the part of the Labour Party that Corbyn comes from, the hard left as it's known, is much, much more prone to see the world in terms of moral absolutes than the centre left of the Labour Party. Almost by definition, the centre left are kind of more interested in kind of winning the votes of more centrist voters or whatever it might be. But there's a photo of a guy at one of the rallies in defence of Corbyn with a T-shirt saying "Eradicate the right-wing Blairite vermin." I know that that's a one-off, but I don't feel that those T-shirts are worn at progress meetings that I've been to.
But you will find a lot of people at progress meetings wearing a T-shirt saying "Never kissed a Tory."
Yeah, you will, and I think that. I also think that is. It's milder on the centre left, but it's still a factor. And I think, in a weird way, part of the reason that Corbynism came as such a shock to those people, to the centre left and people with my politics, is that for a long time we probably had, to a milder level, believed in the kind of Dark Knight view of we're the good guys, and to be outgrouped by the far left, who suddenly said, "No, you're not. You're the bad guys. You voted for Liz Kendall. You voted for Yvette Cooper," was a painful thing, precisely because we had that as a part, you know, in our DNA. As we're Labour, we're morally superior to the Tories. So I think it's part of I think it runs right across the party, and it is a weakness of the party. But I do feel it's more pronounced on the hard left, which I think has a style of politics which is very, very confrontational, and which seeks to draw lines of saying which side are you on. If you're on that side, you're beyond the pale, sort of a thing. And I don't think that that is, I think, don't get me wrong, I think that the centre left has it in it to be highly dismissive and condescending towards the far left, and arguably was for parts of the sort of Blair Brown years, and I don't doubt that. But I don't think the specifically moral arguments go anything like as strongly the other way. I don't think that the Corbynites are generally viewed as self-serving, self-interested, spiteful careerists by the centre-left in the way that the Blairites are viewed in that way by parts of the Corbynite left.
Except possibly Carrie Murphy.
Yes, possibly, yeah.
On that bombshell. I think it's a really interesting book. I would probably say it's quite polemical. It's your view, if you see what I mean, rather than kind of in many ways it's not that pluralist.
it's trying to usher everyone towards pluralism it's trying to make some arguments which are in some ways quite provocative to not just to Labour, but I think to any political party.
It's definitely, yeah. whether you agree with the basis of it or not. I mean, it's very well written, so it's a good read. But it's also, I think, you know, it does challenge people to think about these things. You know, whether they end up agreeing with you, disagreeing with you, or where I am, somewhere in the middle.
Yeah.
It definitely does challenge your thinking. And I think that's something we should all do. I can't bear people who only read stuff that they agree with, because, you know, how do you ever persuade anyone if you never work out what other people think?
Yeah, completely. I think it's, I don't, my argument isn't that we have to absolutely jettison these myths, but I think we've we've got sucked into them in a way where we almost can't see the wood for the trees in the Labour Party. Mm. And we have to get back to a position where we can argue sensibly with ourselves rather than everything being kind of just, you know, the I think it's the phrase is the narcissism of small differences.
We have to get past that point. Well, that I can completely agree with. Brilliant. Well, thank you, Chris. Thank you ever so much for joining me today. The book is called Warring Fictions, Left Populism and Its Defining Myths. And presumably it's available from all good and bad or possibly even morally neutral bookshops.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, thank you very much for having me, Emma.
Cheers. No, you're very welcome. Thank you. And just before I go, I'd like to say thank you to Kevin MacLeod at incompetech.com for our theme tune. And this has been a Political Human production.